We might as well get started a little bit, and this is going to be in many ways sort of a repeat on what I covered the other day. Now, how many of you were here when we talked about the American Legion Convention in Portland? Okay, well, that isn't too much. I'll try and have just a little bit different so it doesn't bore you too much, and if when we're done, then you've had a double chance to think of why we did it wrong, and you can attack me on it. I'm going to cover what Portland, Oregon, not a particularly large city, but probably a representative city, did when it was faced with the potential of a major civil disturbance that could well have erupted during the last week of August, first week of September this year, 1970. And as you may be familiar from reading the newspapers or seeing television in your area, that during this particular period of time, the American Legion held its convention in Portland, Oregon. We heard about the American Legion coming to town and that they were going to bring 25 to 30,000 delegates into Portland, Oregon. Portland, Oregon, something under a half million in the city limits and something over a million in the whole metropolitan area. So it's really not that large of a town. But shortly, or during the spring of the year, we were also informed that there is going to be a massive demonstration, an anti-war demonstration against the American Legion in Portland as a confrontation. And you can't hear this when you're in a municipal type of government without becoming concerned. So all you have to do is look around. You look at Berkeley, look at Newark, look at Detroit, Chicago, Washington, D.C., and all these areas where there have been these types of demonstrations.
Jerry, can you expand the circle just a wee bit, only about a half foot back to this?
Sure.
Just to put in four chairs that all the fire department. Come on. Just come together over here. I'll go upstairs.
It's more simple than the way you
have to go. Just right now. Where did you say you were going?
Now, in the discussion tonight, I'm not going to, or at least I'm going to attempt not to editorialize on what's good or what's bad, but to give you more in a reporter type of a fashion, as if you were looking up legislation and reading the committee reports of what went into it, kind of an approach to explain what went on in Portland, Oregon. And then when I'm done, for the benefit of some of the fellows of college age or a little older, a little younger who might become involved, I'll have just a very short discussion on what to do if you're arrested, because this is something that you should be concerned with as well. When I talked about it earlier in the week, I spent quite a bit of time going into the reasons for the tensions between the demonstrators and the police, and I don't think I'll go into that very deeply tonight. Just mention that I think you are aware of Kent State. I think you're aware of the National Guard being called out there, and the result of their being called out, that there were a couple students killed. I don't want to discuss deeply why our office believes and why the National Guard in Oregon believes that particular event happened. But of course we did look at that event when attempting to plan how our own system would work. But since Kent State, the campuses and the young people who are demonstrating against the war have been pretty uptight about the whole administration of justice, about the political powers being coercive on them, about taking away their rights, and generally being a repressive type of a society. We didn't do very much to take away that feeling in Portland, Oregon during the spring. Portland State University, a growing metropolitan university, as every metropolitan area has now, had a reaction following the Kent State, had a moratorium. And as a result of one of the activities of putting up of a hospital tent that they had used during their demonstration, a violent confrontation erupted between about 200 of these demonstrators and the police, the TAC squad or cop squad, or the riot squad of the police. Due to a breakdown in the communication between the mayor's office, the commissioner, and the leaders of the dissidents, well, let me tell you what it was. The dissidents had received permission from a second line official that they could keep a tent up until 5 o'clock in the afternoon on, say, day number two. The commissioner, who is in charge of all the parks, including the park in which this tent was located, said, I do not honor that authority or that request. He therefore ordered the police to go in and tear it down. No one was talking to anyone else. So the police went in, they ordered them to take the tent down. They would not take the tent down. They formed a barrier in front of it. The police in this particular squad formed into a riot or V-shaped formation with their riot sticks. They were ordered to take down the tent or be to disperse or be arrested. They did not arrest. They moved forward not with arresting procedure, but with a dispersal procedure. They moved in with the riot stick. People were hit. People were hurt. None extremely seriously, if you don't count a few stitches serious. And went through them and took the tent down. I would say that the community is pretty well split over this particular event in Portland, Oregon. A great many members of the community cheer every time you get along here. That's just the nature of them. And these numbers, this is a large percentage of the community. The more liberal, more progressive sections of the community were outraged and shocked at what the police did. So you had a division within our own community over the proper use of law enforcement. A grand jury was called. A special grand jury was called to investigate this. The grand jury in our office, I'm a member of the district attorney's office, made it very clear that they were attempting to make an investigation of what happened, regardless of where the chips fell. This irritated the police, who many times feel that the district attorney's office is only a protection for them. And it certainly irritated the people that took place in the disturbance, because they thought that now they were going to be subject to conspiracy-type indictments for various crimes that, in fact, did occur because of the strike at Portland State and due to the demonstrations afterward. The demonstrators regularly took the Fifth Amendment rather than talk to the grand jury. They would be brought before the presiding judge, would there have a hearing on whether or not they had a right to proceed. And you had a very tense situation between the people of the demonstrating mood and our office and law enforcement and the police in general. All right, it was into this atmosphere then that the American Legion is now brought. Well, the Portland Army, People's Army Jamboree, pardon me, with a group of about 20 people, I don't think there are more than 20, who announced to one and all that they were going to represent the 40 to 50,000 demonstrators that were going to come to Portland, Oregon during this period of time to dissent to confront the American Legion and the policies of the American Legion in supporting the war in Vietnam. The People's Army Jamboree, they rented a building. They used the Willamette Bridge, our local underground newspaper, for a great deal of publicity. come out weekly or bi-weekly, and then advertised up and down the coast. Stranger, the underground newspaper in Seattle, the Berkeley Barb, and all the other newspapers in the San Francisco area, and then the newspapers in the L.A. area. The end of August, the thing is happening in Portland, so come on up to it. So we had the prospects then of 25 to 30,000 Legionnaires, and I might add that as soon as they heard that there was going to be a confrontation, we understand that their registrations went up. It was almost as if the Legionnaires said, "Well, Martha, I'm going to pack my uniform, I'm going to go to Portland and get me a hippie." So we had 25 to 30,000 of these people, of Legionnaires, who had a right to come to Portland for demonstration, regardless of whether we disagree or agree with their views. And we had an unknown number of anti-war demonstrators. And in order to control this group of estimated anywhere between 50 and 100,000 people now, we had 700 policemen. So you can see that right initially, we're not going to overwhelm them with numbers, are we? Now one thing we did feel, and we learned from Kent State, is that when you have an undermanned force out in the field, and when this force is not well trained or well led, and certainly if it's armed under those circumstances, that these guardsmen who are the same age as the demonstrators and certainly don't have a great deal of all the maturity and all the courage possibly that you would like to have them have, that just by the very fact of their own tenuous situation in an extremely dangerous situation for them, that their lack of numbers and their lack of feeling secure creates a greater aura of danger to themselves and to the dissenters than if you would have enough force, or enough force available, rather, in order that they could feel secure in what they were doing. Now, as just very briefly, why the dissonance or the dissenters were uptight, I'd like to just spend a minute to explain to you why the police were probably uptight, too. And because a great deal of your dealing or in your community or our dealing has to be with the police, and a little bit is needed to understand why they do the things they do. And I think that you should know that the attacks on individual policemen are mounting and accelerating every year. They've almost reached a very frightening proportion, that 86 people, policemen, were killed in the line of duty last year, 69, 57 so far this year, and 16 individual policemen have been just killed by sniper fire. And you've read about these, and I'm sure you've read about Omaha, where they called in a burglary call, two policemen or one policeman goes in, and the fake call and a bomb goes off as they go in. Sure, you've read about the bombings of the Oakland police station and in Chicago, where officers with no particular type of animosity between themselves and the community, but simply because they were policemen wearing a blue uniform, were picked off by sniper fire. This, again, creates problems when you're talking to a policeman about being reasonable in this type of a situation. Not justifying anything that policemen do, but I'd like to have you understand the type of thing that they feel that they're confronted with. And of course you understand about bomb threats. Those of you from the Midwest and Minneapolis are particularly aware now of bombs. You from Seattle are aware of bombs. And In Portland, we're starting to get our share of them, too. So when you're looking at this type of a confrontation, the possibility of violence is certainly there. My word, you know, if we'd be afraid to have 30,000 legionaries on the town just parting in their own way without adding to the other part of it. Well, let's get back to the People's Army Jamboree. They announced that they were going to be the representatives in Portland for these 30 or 40 or 50,000 people that are going to come to town. They did their advertising, and they had what was a visible leadership. And I speak about a visible leadership because they would never say, I am the chairman of the People's Army Jamboree, or I am the leader, or would never take an official position of leadership. They would claim that for themselves, in this type of a new, modern, free organization, that leadership would change and flow, and that you could never pick one person and say, well, yes, I'm the leader of that group, and I can speak for the group. They had some people who ended up speaking regularly, and so we dealt with them. But we had an initial problem that you had no real visible leadership. And we felt that there was another leadership who never became visible and was never actually located in Portland. And they did not become visible because it would be to their disadvantage to have been visible. But there are a few people. There's a Kevin Mulligan, Bob Wolheim, and a McCusker, and I may use these names when I'm going along, who were the visible leadership. McCusker was a Vietnam veteran, 27 years old. He'd been dishonorably discharged from the Marine Corps. Bob Wolheim, a fine, bright young man, went to Reed College in Portland, Oregon. He was drafted and refused to enter, and he spent a year and 6 months in federal confinement as refusing to be drafted, but a bright man, a good man to deal with. There's another man by the name of Kevin Mulligan who honestly said that he was a revolutionary, that he was going to do everything he could to tear down the system, but who during the problems at Portland State, as far as we could tell, had been a calming influence when it came to violence within that particular situation. And they announced that their goals were that they were going to confront the American Legion, that there was going to be a march of the victory for the Vietnamese people. They wanted praise for it. They wanted workshops. But they also announced right from the start that all their type of demonstration was going to be peaceful. Now, they also stated very clearly that they were a loose coalition of all the people who were going to come to Portland. And they made it very clear that they could not be responsible for other groups who might come in under their broad general umbrella. Now, who are these other groups? Well, there's a White Panther Party who are partially made up of the Weathermen, and the Weathermen being a very extremist organization. And I'm only giving you now what their own publications declare. The White Panthers, in their publications, go out completely that the only way to achieve the desired ends is by killing people. And that pick up a machine gun, pick up grenades, pick up guns, kill people, shoot policemen, because by doing that, they will then achieve the gains of revolution, the decadent capitalistic society will be thrown over, and people will be able to be free again. The Seattle Liberation Front, that happens to be a very varied group from what we understand, that there are some factions of it which are simply very radical, and there are other sections of it that are very close to the White Panther Party as far as advocating direct violence and bombing. Then we have a Black Panther organization in Seattle. or in Portland rather, and we were never quite sure what they were going to do. We are aware of what they have done in the past. They made no vocal claims of what they would do during the American Legion Convention. But I think when you, the problem now in planning as far as government is concerned, is you try and look at all your possibilities. And so there's always a possibility that they would either join up in this type of a demonstration, because another goal of the People's Army Jamboree was to have a march on racism, or let the town kind of explode over another type of a confrontation and then work their own confrontation in their own area. I know that Willie would, Hirschfeld was up here this year, and I'm not condemning the Black Panther Party now entirely, but much of their literature does include and promote the use of violence. We believe they have been violent on particular occasions in our area, and at least as far as planning is concerned, we felt that we had to consider their presence in developing our plans and being concerned with them. Now, in Portland, I mentioned the problem we had of breakdown of communication in government. We ended up with a consolidated governmental function in Portland. We were able to combine the city and the county governments and working together with the state government, and so that we were able to speak with one voice to the dissident groups. About an hour's talk on how we pulled that off too. But for purposes tonight, it took a great deal of effort, but we were able to get the mayor to assume the entire power for the city, the commissioner of the county, the chairman of the county commissioners, worked with him, and then my boss, the district attorney, worked together with the other two to forming a nucleus and a joint executive committee for the city government, and then liaison people worked tightly with Governor McCall, and in fact during the week they set up a combined headquarters over in the Hilton Hotel. And so with this unified governmental control, we were in a position of negotiating with the People's Army Jamboree. Now, this is something that they were not able to do in Chicago, for instance. Now, again, we attempted to learn from what Chicago did. We attempted to learn from what Kent State did. We felt that Chicago made a very grave error, that when at the Democratic Convention the demonstrators requested a permit for a park, and the city officials did not give it to them. I'm not going to go back and criticize Daley for what he did, but for our purposes, we felt that if in that situation, by hindsight, if Daley would have given them a park, put them in one spot, allowed them to use their First Amendment rights the way they had a right to use them, that quite likely the major problems in Chicago would have been avoided. So with this attitude, we began our negotiations with the People's Army Jamboree. Now, before government was unified, they had gone before the city council and had demanded the use of Washington Park for camping out of 25 to 30,000 people. Washington Park is a park about 10 blocks away from the downtown area, from the Hilton Hotel, the center of the American Legion Convention. Rose gardens, tennis courts, a highly developed park, close to a residential area, and it's the type of thing that the city just could not give them. Well, they were fighting back and forth, and the city did not act in a very responsible way in the way they were using this as a political game against the demonstrators. The demonstrators were here initially, much more reasonable, and really had the political advantage over government. If you would sit from the outside and look in and try and balance both, at that stage of the game, the demonstrators were being much more reasonable than government was being. Well, after government was unified, we talked to the People's Army Jamboree and said, all right, fellas, you can't have Washington Park, but you're going to be here. You're going to come into this area, so we're going to give you Delta Park. Now, Delta Park is a large park. I don't know how many acres, 250 acres or something like that, a very large park on the north end of town, where there's adequate room for sanitary facilities, water, cooking, and all this other stuff. 7 miles from town. They said all the people were foot people and they couldn't get to downtown, but we said, all right, you can get buses or you can take cars, and we'll give you a parking area downtown, so if you live out there and camp out there, then you can come down and park your cars here before you begin your parades and your demonstrations. They ended up not using it, but they ended up not using Washington Park either. And it at least gave us in government the right to do our planning around the condition that if they would have gone in and attempted to camp at Washington Park, it wouldn't have been a matter of moving in forces to have thrown them out into the street and then just continue harassment from that time on. We at least have the right to have the initial response of saying, look, fellas, you know you can't stay here, but we have provided a park for you. Now, won't you please go out there? At least the initial reasonableness. And we think that it was a fair situation to act in that manner. Now, in looking at the whole plan that we had for Portland, I'd like to begin with the constitutional rights that all the people had. Now, I've mentioned that the American Legion had a right to come to town, and they certainly did. But the dissenters had a right to come to town, too. And they had a First Amendment right. They had a right to freedom of speech. And if they didn't think the war was right, they had as much right to come to Portland, Oregon, and take advantage of the publicity surrounding the American Legion Convention to make these rights known, as the American Legion had the right to come to Portland and say the war is the greatest thing in the world. That was their privilege. And so it was our duty as government to see that that right was protected. Then, by reviewing the criticisms of the Kerner Report, we knew that if some things did erupt, that if government is to work as a system, it has to work when things go wrong in the first instance. If people disobey the law, then government must itself obey its law when handling these people. And we knew that the criticisms have been from the Kerner Report that if you had a mass demonstration, the police would go in and arrest hundreds of people, just take them off the street, but would very seldom prosecute them. Now, prosecution might not sound like a good word to you, but what we're really talking about is if you're going to arrest a person and put him in jail, he has now fallen within the judicial process, and he should have the right to not be just harassed on the street. But that officer who has taken him off the street should be prepared to carry through, to make a report, and to see that that man is brought before the bar of justice, where he's either going to be held to be guilty or not guilty. You don't have summary justice in the street. It should come from the court and not from a riot stick. We didn't want busted heads in Portland. We wanted the system to work. And so they did have a right to be charged. If they were going to be arrested, they had a right to a speedy trial. They had a right to have an attorney. They had a right not to be burdened with excessive bail. Now, all these rights were not given to the demonstrators in Chicago, the demonstrators in Newark, the demonstrators in Detroit, the demonstrators in Watts, Washington, or any other area. Government did not follow its own laws when it was meeting the demonstrators who had violated other laws. And it was our feeling in Portland that the system can work. The governmental system can work if you let it. But that means that government has got to follow its own rules. Now we begin then first with the theory of we will be reasonable with these people. They have a right to dissent. Therefore, if they want a parade permit, they can have a parade permit. Now they began by asking for a permit to march in the same time in the same place as the American Legion was marching. Now we thought that might lead to trouble. And so City Council did not give them that type of a permit. But they gave them a permit to march, the American Legion parade was on a Monday. The demonstrators were given a right, first of all, to march on the Sunday afternoon preceding the American Legion parade. They were given the right to have what they call a victory in for the Vietnamese people march on that day. Okay. They wanted to have an end to racism march. Now, they originally wanted to have a torchlight parade at 8 o'clock in the evening during the week. Well, we said, well, now, gang, if you're going to say that you're going to have members in the group who might be dissident, who that you cannot control, don't you really think that having a torchlight parade through the center of town at 8 o'clock at night is a little dangerous? Because say you only have 20 or 30 or 50 people mingling in a crowd of X thousand, it'd be very simple for them to use that as a cover, get them to a certain area, break out, and then you've got yourself some real problems in this area. So they were given the right to have that parade at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I'm now talking about our planning and the rights they were given, and we'll get what happened at the parade a little later. All right, we also felt that after being reasonable, and by the way, the National Guard fell and supported this program immediately. I was able to talk to the general in charge of the National Guard very early in the game, last part of July, first part of August, and he was aware of what happened at Kent State. And, you know, he said, it's not going to happen here. Our guardsmen will be under control. He was willing to go in if we would have provided Della Clark, and this was 3 to 4 weeks before City Council got around to doing it, that he would have his guardsmen there taking care of a hospital tent, that he would have guardsmen taking care of sanitary facilities and providing them, and then he didn't know what he could do as far as food is concerned because of the financing of it, but at least he would be able to supply the pots and pans and that type of thing necessary. So we had initially a general who was now aware of the bad publicity, if nothing else, that went on in Kent State, and I would like to give him a little bit more credit than only bad publicity, that he understood that his role was not to kill other people. That, you know, the people out on the street could just as well be his children as well as the children of other people. So after we have gone through the program now of being reasonable, we also have to be ready. And the first step in being ready is we wanted to be able to separate the violent leadership from the great masses of people. Now, we felt that if we would have a 20,000 or more crowd, that most of these people would probably be sincere, dedicated people who believed that the war was wrong and simply wanted to get out and demonstrate against it in Portland during the moratorium, over with very little advance warning, 10,000 people, mainly from the middle walks of life, businessmen and so forth, demonstrated against the war by marching through the town. And we felt that most of the people that would come would be on that type of a group. We also knew, through our intelligence network, that there would be a smaller group of extremely violent people, the bombers, the snipers, and the people that could take a situation, a confrontation, and all at once, rather than having it something that you could handle, with that many people, you could have it exploding into a war. And so we wanted to separate these people from the masses. And we had two ways of doing it. First of all, was psychologically, or philosophically. And by the very fact of our being reasonable, that gave the violent leaders less of a hold and less of a control over the great mass of people that were there. The great mass of people, we felt, understood, you know, when people are trying to go along with them. During the week before the problem in Portland, the great mass of people got along very well with the police. And we also felt that in looking around, as well as we could perceive, that usually where things got out of hand, that it was questionable whether the demonstrators started the trouble, whether the police may have overreacted a little bit too soon, but as soon as the blows began to fall, it really didn't matter who started them and why. After the first shot, after the first, whether the police would be moving back in self-defense or whether or not they would have been charging in the first instance, didn't really matter that after you got that flame going, the thing could explode very, very rapidly. So again, we had to restrain the police. Well, it's a little bit out of context here, but still that's part of the philosophy of the thing, that we did not allow the violent leaders to gain control over the great masses by an error on the part of the police force. And then we also had injunctions prepared. An injunction is a court order that particular people cannot go into a particular area. We ended up not using these. We spent a couple months preparing them, getting information for them, but because things ended up working fairly well, that we followed with our theory that the less the government interfered or made itself felt, the better off the government was, as long as things moved smoothly. All right. Now, we prepared to have the court system work on a 24-hour basis. In Detroit, people would be picked up, would be moved from precinct to precinct, and could be held for a week and never see a court, never see a judge, and then be released. Things happened similar to that in Stanford University. Things happened similar to that in Berkeley, California. Simply not an acceptable procedure within our system. The jail system had to be prepared. If you're going to make mass arrests, if you're going to take people off the street for violating the law and arrest them, government then is required to take care of them, feed them, provide proper medical care, and treat them as they deserve to be treated, as citizens who are charged with a crime. Therefore, we had Rocky Butte Jail, the county jail, and we cleared that jail, took all the prisoners from that jail down to Oregon State Prison, and prepared the county jail for a mass arrest type situation. We worked out a system together with the Multnomah County Bar to provide teams of defense attorneys, and so that as soon as the people would be brought into the court system or jail, that they would immediately be appointed with an attorney to represent them, and that if bail could be set, bail would be set at the proper amount, or if they were people that could be released on their own recognizance, they would be released on their own recognizance. And to avoid the accusation, or the fact even, that because this type of thing developed around an anti-war demonstration or a civil disturbance, that they had any less right to the legal procedure than if they had been picked up for burglary or car theft or any other type of crime. In fact, they were getting a type of a system or program that the normal person being arrested could not expect. And another part of the thing is that we wanted to involve all units of the community. Now, before we got into it, there was an independent unit called People for Portland who had banded together. Now, they were kind of a problem during the planning stages, but when it came down to the actual demonstrations, they were very valuable. And this is something that you, as citizens in your own community, together with your own church, might be interested in doing. Now, these were simply professors getting together with their peers or ministers getting together with their parishioners, who said, now look, if we're out and among the demonstrators, we can be a calming influence out on the street. We can keep that first spark from igniting and sending the whole thing out. That they could talk, use persuasion, use a minor amount of force if necessary in order to control the group. One of them said that he read Jerry Rubin's book, and Rubin's book indicated that if there was even a small amount of people that did not want to demonstrate in the group, that the group could not be led and could not work. The People for Portland hoped to provide that type of stabilizing influence in the crowds, that they had marshals together with the crowd. Now, they were brought into the picture, and they did work out fairly well. Now, it ended up in Portland that it never really got that close to coming unglued or getting very, very violent. And it's hard to say exactly why. I have some opinions, but I'm sure that most of the things that were done had some influence on it. But I want to give all the credit to the people for Portland that they can possibly deserve, because I think it's very important that citizens, concerned citizens, whether they're conservative or liberal, feel that they can get together in an area and help prevent a problem. Then our office, together with the planning, also felt that it's very important that there are attorneys out in the field with the police. We felt that if the district attorneys were out there, that if this would have a calming and cooling effect on the police. If the police have a certain amount of healthy fear for the district attorney, because we can call a grand jury, or grand jury will be called, and the police are there subject to discipline. We don't threaten the police. We get along very well with the police in our office. But the very fact that now the police officer's activity is subject to the scrutiny of the lawyer in the field modifies the police officer's activity to some degree, we felt. So we had a plan of staging areas set up that if a demonstration would occur, a team of four attorneys together with a notary would go into the demonstration or riot area that they would set up a staging area within a block or half a block of the disturbance, that security would be provided either by the National Guard or by the police, and that immediately upon arrest that the individual would be brought into the staging area. He would there be photographed, that the officer would dictate a report, that the attorney out there in the field would pencil in and handwrite out the complaint or the formal charge against him. The Polaroid photograph would be stapled onto the complaint, and so the whole procedure was now moving within a judicial type of a framework. The National Guard was called in on this, and as a matter of fact, they at the time did provide armored vans for the attorneys. And we also felt that by working this way, out in the field, exposing ourselves, that the police, rather than simply hearing us all the time, would understand that we felt strongly enough about it that we'd get our tail out there in the field, where the action was, rather than just tell them how to do their job. Now, in following this through, we had to sell it to the various law enforcement agencies. I'll go through this real briefly. We sold it to the National Guard. Our people went up and lectured to every National Guardsman that came into the area as to the proper use of force, and we also told them that if people would be hurt, that they, as guardsmen, would be subject to investigation by the grand jury, and that their status as a guardsman did not grant them immunity if they violated the law, even though they did so in uniform. We had some problems of people from other law enforcement agencies going right behind our people lecturing and saying, these are smart-alecky, long-haired college kids that don't know anything about it, disregard everything they say and do it our way. One of the guardsmen wrote a diary of this. This was published and reported in the paper. The governor got a letter, copy of the letter. The general got a copy of the letter. We got a copy of the letter. They kind of sat down and discussed the matter between themselves, and then the governor said that his people knew how to follow orders, and that we never had any more trouble with the guards. You're going to have bad people, no matter what you're dealing with. If you're dealing with that many law enforcement people, you're going to have some that want to break heads. And simply a matter of our recognizing it and repeating and repeating and repeating the lesson that the system will work, but don't break heads in the process. We worked with the Portland Police Bureau, the Oregon State Police, Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, and explaining to them, among other things, the alternates to arrest. And one of the things that we were afraid they were going to do in the planning was during the American Legion parade, that they're going to get out and lay down in front of the parade, a customary tactic they've had. Well, the plan of the guard was, law enforcement people, they wanted to go out there and lay down, they could lay down. And the parade would just march around them, and they would be told to stay there. They were under arrest, and after the parade was gone, they would say, all right, we'll just have our van drive up behind them. And at that time, the arrest would be made, rather than going in and fighting at that time. Another potential that they were talking about was that there was a demonstration going on. You don't have to go in and take the demonstrator, the lawbreaker, let me now say. There's nothing wrong with demonstrating, but there is a law against rioting. And that you can simply photograph the individual. And after the photograph, you swear out a complaint, and then you arrest him at a later time. In so doing, you're not increasing the potential for demonstration. or violence by what you do. Very shortly before the actual demonstration started, one of the leaders of the dissident groups called me up and said he wanted to talk about the potentials of non-violent arrest, or I think that was the term that he used for it. That they wanted to make a political gesture, he said. And explained to him that you have various situations. That you have one, if all the demonstrators are sitting down and they want to be arrested, and the officer can come up and say, all right, you're under arrest, please come with me. Under that type of a thing, there's no need ever for violence, is there? The officer can put his hand on his shoulder, they can get up, go away, and be arrested. Now, you have another one if they're sitting together and all the demonstrators lock arms, and then the officer begins to take one away and two other people pull him. And so you have a tug of war with an individual. Now, this is a type of a situation that lends itself to violence beginning to escalate. And you have a third situation where they're all locked together and the people at the back are throwing rocks and bolts and that time over the top and bombarding the police with some sort of missiles. And, they could concede that the level of resistance made the job different for the police. I'm running a little long here, so I'll just whip right into the what happened here. A week prior to the convention, Attorney General Mitchell was in town on August 22nd speaking to the National District Attorneys Convention. And, that's all we needed with the National District Attorneys Convention followed by the American Legion Convention. In between, we had Hickel was in town and... Grant was in town too, so for about a 2-week period there, gee whiz, they didn't have to. We had a special invitation out for every dissenter in the country going. But during that convention, that particular thing, we had kind of a practice run to see how our people would work. And the demonstrators walked around. In fact, I got up between salad and the main course and, got outside and walked around with them. The police would stand at the entryways quietly. The demonstrators would run up to them and yell a little bit. The police would stand there. And that's all that happened. They got a little tired of going around the Hilton Hotel for a while. So there's a Georgia Pacific building about a block and a half away where other officers were stationed. So they thought, gee, we'll try these people on. And so they go charging down there, and they really didn't have much of a group. They had about 200, if that. But still, 200 people can raise a little cane up there, if you mind to. And so the police were there, about 20 of them. And they spotted them, and they wanted to try something out. And so they go charging up to within about 30 feet of them, and there are a few of the White Panthers in the front. And they were yelling, let's get them, and throwing the bird at the police, and trying to arouse them. And the police just kind of sat back and took it easy. And pretty soon... it just dissolved. They could not get anything going until the police would come back and react to the name calling and to the other type of verbal abuse that they were taking. So after that went off, we felt pretty good. We thought that the police at least were in line. Oh, and that night we also found out that there's a four-quart fountain in Portland where they have a fake waterfall. And they had about 400 people up there, and they couldn't get anybody to come down to join them. And they went up to Washington Park, and they couldn't get anybody to come down then as well. So things were looking pretty good for us at that time, we felt. Well, oh, by the way, also the governor had given a state park over during the time of the American Legion Convention for the use of all the out-of-towners that were supposed to come into town, the Guyver State Park. I personally don't think it had a great deal of effect on what happened. I don't want to talk about it too much, except that he did put on a park, have a park, it was available, and there was a considerable amount of drug abuse out there,
but I don't really think it kept anybody out of town. But now during the prior week, or week immediately prior to the convention, people began drifting into town. Now our intelligence, coordinated intelligence agency, who had included for the past month, or the month prior to that, Army intelligence, the Secret Service, FBI, and all local intelligence agencies were now funneling their information together. And they had indicated that people were not too interested any longer coming up from Los Angeles or San Francisco, but they were coming up in small numbers. And a couple people came into town with warrants for them. There was an individual from Kansas had come in and one from California. And during the middle of the week, as soon as they hit town, they were spotted, recognized, and they were immediately arrested on out-of-state warrants and taken into custody. Perfectly legitimate procedure. We felt that by this type of activity, the demonstrators, the violent demonstrators, understood that we knew who was in town and who wasn't in town, and that we were ready to respond. There was a raid on the White Panther headquarters during this period of time, subject to a search warrant, and a great many guns were removed from the premises together with other items of explosives. We think that may have had some sort of an effect upon their further planning during the week. Now the National Guard came into town and it was put on the ready. Now it was our decision that we did not want to show force. We didn't want to make Portland look like an armed camp. One of the people in the governor's office during wanted to have guardsmen lined up around along the route of the American Legion parade, and we simply avoided that type of thing. We did not want to make this look like a repressive society. On the other hand, we wanted protection. So during these major events, the guardsmen were stationed inside of parking garages in downtown Portland. They were there. They were there in 4 to 8 platoon strength, but no one ever saw them as far as the general citizenry went. Now, the People's Army Jamboree saw them. They had originally been funded with $10,000 when they set up their program, or set it up, and a good deal of the money went into buying radio equipment. And so we would see their spotters around with their walkie-talkies, you know, looking at the guardsmen looking at them. And so, well, that was great, you know, as far as we were concerned. We were telling them, they were finding out the types of things that we would call them up on the phone and told them. In addition, we did provide them with state police radio so we could be in contact with their leadership during this whole time as well. Well, during the Sunday, they had this march of the victory for the Vietnamese people. And it really didn't get off the ground. It really didn't get off the ground. They burned an American flag in a park that we had given to them for a staging area. Again, the reasonablest type of a program. They followed their parade route, which went within 2 blocks of the police station and then made a left turn. They walked down carrying the Viet Cong flag, shouting up, you know, their particular phrases, Ho 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 Chi Minh, and Revolution Now, and their other slogans. But it made the turn. It came down to within 2 blocks, and then it followed their route. They made their turn. They went back up, went up to their park, and dispersed. You know, got a little tense along the way. Other times, in other places, there would have been arrests for disorderly conduct for what they had done. This way, time the police just took the gas. They turned their corner, did not react, and nothing happened. During the American Legion parade, the parade started, and you know, their parade is a bore when you get right down to it. There's nothing, there can't be many things more boring than watching the American Legion convention parade. You know, everybody's marching up and down. There were enough plainclothes detectives out there in the field to make a fairly good audience for them. Well, they would show up, and then the demonstrators would go on the sidewalk carrying their Viet Cong flags, and I happened to be near the Bank of California, and this one demonstrator was standing up there on the top floor holding out the Viet Cong flag. And here came a sailor, and the sailor thought that he was going to protect America now, and he was going to take on this demonstrator and just really whip up on him. Well, he made about three steps towards him, and this demonstrator was surrounded by detectives. He must have had 10 detectives between himself and the sailor. And everybody was grabbing the sailor and saying, "All right, now, fellow, we don't need to do this." And he was really uptight. Well, that demonstrator was never safer in his entire life as when that sailor wanted to take him on, because we weren't going to let some fight erupt here that could then generate. So we got tired of being there, and so the demonstrator got tired. So he had to move himself down into a more exposed location, right on the street where the Legionnaires were going by. Credit to the Legion where it's due, they were told not to react, and they didn't react. They'd go by him, and he's holding out the flag. A policeman came and stood very close to him, chatted with him, asked him how he liked the weather and how things were in Portland and that type of thing. They had a Legionnaire came by, or two of them were walking by. One was a very tall, colored gentleman, and the other looked as if he was an old Indian scout. You know, he was 1,000 years old. And he had a beard down about his belt line, and some Indian fringe growing up going up the side of his trousers. So the one guy runs out there in the street, wraps his arm around this guy, holds the flag up, and the photographer for the underground newspaper comes up and snaps his picture. And Zango about like that, he's off the street. You know, I believe it's a fellow from the People of Portland. The citizen group came up and said, "Fella, I think you better leave the street." He left the street and nothing happened. I don't think there was one arrest on the day of that parade. The following day, we now have our third parade. This was the end of racism day. And this is one we thought really might get out of hand. This is when it began at 5 o'clock. Well, the intelligence is going back and forth during the day, trying to find out what's going on.